Well, it's a real pleasure having you here because, first up, I've been quite aware of your work over the years. In fact, when my son was growing up, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood was a family ritual for us. We all watched it, all three of us watched it, and all of us learned and benefited from it. And one of the nice things about the way you work on television and your dealings with children is I don't think there's an ounce of patronizing to children. You talk to, and I know that adults tend to do this. The first thing an adult will say to a child is, "How old are you?" "Well, what grade are you in?" A child will rarely go to an adult and say, "How old are you?" This sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. Most of us don't have that knack. I know I don't. But most of us don't have that knack. Yeah, we do tend to patronize children, don't we?
I think it must come from having been patronized, if we do. I feel that attitudes are caught rather than taught. And something must have happened with me when I was a kid to have learned that childhood is very valuable and children have an enormous amount of value. Otherwise, I don't think that I would have been able to use my whole professional life in working with children. I think it's that way with pediatricians who are successful in their work, with early childhood educators. Somewhere along the way, they got the notion that children had very great value, not for who they would be, but for who they are. And how could I, or anyone who has learned as much as I have from children, ever be patronizing to my teachers?
That's an interesting thought. To your teachers, you learn from children.
Oh, yes. I think I've learned enormously from children. I've worked with children for many years and have consulted with those who know children best for many years. For instance, the people who founded our Family and Children's Center at the University of Pittsburgh, where I did my graduate work, were Ben Spock, Eric Erickson, and Margaret McFarland. And Eric Erickson once said to me, "Fred, you know Margaret McFarland probably knows more about children than anyone in the world." And Margaret has been our senior consultant for the neighborhood for over 20 years. So I have had the luxury of working with those who have spent a lifetime in understanding the needs of childhood.
One thing worries me, or puzzles me, I guess, about children. When my child was young, I would see him and the other children on the playground, and it struck me that they were very aggressive, that somehow behavior has to be learned along the line, that it doesn't come naturally. We talk about the innocence of childhood. Children don't look very innocent out there in the playground. They're bumping each other. They're taking each other's things. They're fighting. There seems to be a sense of desperation on the playground. We may learn, as you say, from children, but children also have to learn from adults, don't they, in order to know what society expects of them?
They certainly do. And they learn it by observing us. And I wonder how much violence they learn by observing adults and by observing the kinds of things that adults create. However, early on, there is a time when children are very naturally exceedingly aggressive. they're trying to annihilate the monsters of their fantasy. And anybody or anything can become one of those monsters, particularly when children are 4 or 5, and their fantasies are so scary. So it's only natural that they would create things that would put them in control. It's a very healthy thing. But as time goes on, they're able to see that through their play and through their other creative endeavors, they're really able to make something of value of what their environment is. But it takes a lot of experimenting, a lot of playing.
A lot of mistakes.
Uh-huh.
You went into the ministry, didn't you?
Well, I did that alongside of my television work. I went to the seminary on my lunch hour while I was doing a live one-hour daily program called The Children's Corner.
Well, did this happen when you after you had graduated from the University of Pittsburgh?
No, that was even after the seminary. I graduated from Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida in 1951 with a major in music composition. And then I came to New York as a floor manager for NBC. I was expecting to go to seminary, but I saw some television when I was home for Easter vacation. I said, I think that's what I should do. So instead of going full-time to the seminary, I came full-time to a very new industry in New York, and that was called television. And I worked on such programs as The Voice of Firestone and the NBC Opera Theater and the Hit Parade and the Kate Smith Hour. For instance, Giancarlo Menotti wrote A Mall and the Night Visitors for our opera division at NBC. I shouldn't be talking about NBC so much.
No,
this is CBS.
No, that's all right. But that was in the 50s. I remember seeing that broadcast. It was live, wasn't it?
It was live. And Leonard Bernstein wrote Trouble in Tahiti for that division. I was very proud to be associated with that particular division of NBC. Kirk Browning has directed most of television opera, continues to. He was one of the people I worked with first there. It was fun to grow up with this new medium. In fact, I often wonder if I hadn't started early on, if there would have ever been a chance for a program like ours to come along now. I wonder if I were just to walk into some network executive office and present this new program called Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, if I wouldn't be laughed out of the room. It's very different, Don, from the usual fare. And yet those adults who watch it carefully know how much care is put into its creation, production.
I believe that, and I also believe watching it as a young father when my kid, who's now almost 19, was growing up, we learned from it as well. I never felt that the broadcast was strictly for children. It was aimed at children, had the elements that children needed, but I think any adult who watches that broadcast today will also benefit and learn something from it in dealing with his own children. And I think you've had that in mind, haven't you?
Well, it certainly has been a dividend. I'm not sure that I had that in mind early on, but through the years we've heard of so many parents who have watched over their children's shoulders or right beside them. And now we're hearing about people who grew up with the neighborhood who are offering it to their children. And what a joy that is for me to think that these parents already know who X the Owl and King Friday the 13th and Henrietta Pussycat and all of the others are, and that it meant something to them. It's like reading a favorite book of yours or a favorite nursery rhyme of yours to your own child. It's much more important if you have feelings of warmth about that. What you pass on to your children, you know, Eric Erickson once said that tradition to human beings is like instinct to animals. Well, imagine if animals would lose their instincts. Well, it's just as devastating if human beings lose their traditions. Not that every generation doesn't make some change, but it's change within limits.
I want to get to your books in a minute, but I want to go back a little bit because this was quite interesting. The fact that when you graduated from Rollins, you had studied music and you went into television, and I think the perception is that somehow you got into television as an offshoot of the ministry or something like that. So it didn't happen that way. When somehow you wound up in Pittsburgh, I assume that you left NBC to get your graduate degree in Pittsburgh. Is that how that worked?
No, public television was starting in Pittsburgh. And I applied. My friends at NBC thought I was crazy. I was about to become a network director. And something said to me, try this new work. And so I applied to this station and became one of the half dozen people who was selected to get it on the air. And so we moved to Pittsburgh and got WQED started in 1954. And that's the first community-sponsored television station in the country. Well, not anybody wanted to do a children's program. So beside setting up the program schedule, I said, well, I'll be glad to try to do a children's program. When I was in New York, every day that I had free, I went to visit some place that took care of kids. I don't know why. But I'd go to a hospital or an orphanage or a daycare center or any place that was caring for children. And so it seemed natural that I might want to do something for children. And one of the secretaries, whose name was Josie Carey, said, well, I'd like to try that too. So along with her secretarial duties, she became the hostess. The night before we went, we hadn't planned to use puppets. We thought we would just use free films that I could get from all over the country. And she would introduce them and we would sing songs. I was a songwriter, so why not sing songs? The night before we went on the air, our general manager, Mrs. Dorothy Daniel, gave me a tiger puppet, just for fun. So that's why I called him Daniel Tiger. And he didn't say anything, but we just cut a hole in the set. It was such a last-minute thing. And I just said for Daniel,
hello, Josie. It's 5:04 and Columbus discovered America in 1492.
And that was all he said, and I thought maybe that would probably be all he ever would say. But these films that we got were old, they were free, they were old, and they were brittle. And they would often break. And so everything was live in those days. And when the engineer said, film's broken, That meant that we had to do something, Josie and I. Well, we didn't have enough songs to fill an hour every day. And so I had a bag of puppets at home. Among them was a king and a French-looking tiger. And, I mean, we just added to it. It's just unbelievable how people do things when they have to. I should say it's believable how people do things when they have to. And that's really, those are the roots of the neighborhood of make-believe.
At what point did it turn into Mr. Rogers' neighborhood?
That did not happen in Pittsburgh. I was 8 years with that program that I was playing the organ and doing the puppets for. As a matter of fact, that's where the sneakers started. The organ was at one end of the studio, and the puppet set was at the other end of the studio, and I used to have to run from one to the other, and so that's why I started wearing sneakers, so I wouldn't be heard. But during those 8 years, I went to the seminary and finally graduated and was ordained in the Presbyterian Church and thought that I was going to do a program for children after my graduation. What happened was that the day before I graduated, the National Church called and said, "We're sorry, we don't have the funds that we thought we would have to make the program." The day after graduation, a friend of mine from Canada called. He was head of children's programming for the CBC. And he said, "Fred, I wonder if you'd do a daily program for us up here on our network." And I said, "As a matter of fact, yes. I was just told the day before that I wasn't going to be able to do what I thought." So I went up there to Toronto thinking that I would be doing puppets and music the way I had in Pittsburgh. And when I arrived, Dr. Rainsbury said, "Fred, I have seen you talk with kids. I'd like you to translate that to television." Well, I said, "Well, if you want, we'll try." And so it was his idea for me to be on the camera and to call it Mr. Rogers. So I don't know what would have happened if I'd never gone to Canada. It would be a very different time.
That was the first Mr. Rogers neighborhood in Canada.
Yes.
When did it come south of the border?
A year later. I decided that I wanted to raise the boys in the United States. And so my assistant puppeteer, who had come with me, Ernie Coombs, is a very creative person. And I said, "Why don't you build..." They didn't want me to leave. And I said, "Well, I'll help you. Let's build something around Ernie Coombs." Well, they bought that. Ernie is still doing a program on the CBC network called Mr. Dress-Up. So, you know, we've got the best of both worlds. He's still doing his program there. I came back down here thinking that I would probably do some work for the church. But there were so many people who asked me to carry on the television work that's what I've done.
You went back to Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
to QED to do this. And that has always been the host station?
It has, yes.
When did it resume in this country, or when did it start in this country? What year do you recall?
About 1963. And I think that we started out with a network of 5 stations. And now there are about 280.
You've been on a continuous basis since then.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about your books, because you've written several books. The latest, of course, published by Putnam's, are Making Friends and Moving. But these aren't your first, because, I've seen a number of others. Tell me about the first Mr. Rogers book, I guess, if we can go back that far.
In this first experience series, we started out with going to daycare and the new baby. And then the next year, we added going to the doctor and going to the potty. And this year, we've added making friends and moving. We do 2 of these each year, and they're turning into quite a library. And these are first experiences in the lives of children. I told somebody the other day that I think that these first experience books are probably the best expression of our philosophy aside from the neighborhood. And I like to think that they're used by parents to start family communications. That if you hold a child in your lap and you happen to be anticipating a move from one home to another, and you have this book called Moving, almost every page is something that a child could pick up on if he or she wanted to, and that's what they're for. They're just springboards for talking at home.
Well, it's interesting. We were talking a moment ago about violence on the playground and this sort of thing, but and I believe in making friends, that's exactly the issue you address in this book, isn't it? What children should do to make friends. Here are photographs of children tussling over an object. How to socialize themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a very good word, is it? But how to make friends, I guess, is the word to use.
Sure. It says there are times when friends like to do the same things and other times when they don't. And it isn't always easy for friends to decide what they want to do when they're together. And when one friend tries hard to do things one way and another friend tries hard to do things another way, those friends can get angry with each other. But it also goes on to talk about how even when friends get angry, they can talk about it, or they can talk with somebody that they love about it.
Now, what age bracket are the books aimed at?
Usually for the same age as the neighborhood, and I'm fairly reluctant to say what that should be, because there are so many older people who are watching the neighborhood. For instance, I was at a college graduation last week, and 2,000 members of the graduating class got up and sang, "It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood," when I stood up. And it's not just because they knew the neighborhood when they were little. It's that they sometimes watch now. But it's planned as a program for children from 2 to 6. I've always thought of it as pretty much a preschool program.
But the text is written in a way that children who can read it, and other younger children who can't read the text obviously can be read to them by their parents or their friends. How do you plan the books? Do you work side by side with a photographer?
We do. Jim Judkus is a wonderful photographer. Margie Whitmer, who is the producer of the books, goes with him on location. She and I talk about the possibilities of pictures before she ever goes. There are a lot of families who like to help us with these books, and we go over pictures of those families, and I find it a fascinating process because it's very different from producing a television program. With a television program, you have to have everybody come into the studio pretty much and get it coordinated that way. But with still photographs, that can happen over a period of time.
But the photographer works from the text.
Oh, yes. The text is developed first.
Well, with two books a year, I guess all of these, I guess they start in hardcover, and then they come in paperback, or are they simultaneously published in hardcover and paper?
Simultaneously, yes.
And Putnam is going to keep them in print.
I trust
you
that
hope.
They are.
You hope they, but they are the kinds of books that just don't go out of date, that they are, in effect, resource books for young children.
I trust that they'll be well used. A lot of love and care go into the production of the things that family communications
produce. I can see that. How is it living in Pittsburgh, which incidentally is my old hometown, to a degree? I went to high school there. Lived in Pittsburgh for about 4 years before I went off to college. But you must like Pittsburgh quite a bit to have gone back and to stay there and not move the show to another location.
It's a friendly place. My grandmother used to say she thought it was probably the largest small town in this country. And we certainly find it that way. It was a grand place to raise both of our sons. And they've both elected to stay there.
How old are they?
They're in their late 20s now.
What do they do?
Our older son is the person who does all of the filming for the heart catheterizations at a hospital in Pittsburgh. And his wife works at our public television station, WQED. She schedules all the engineers. The younger son is just changing jobs now. He's thinking of going into selling insurance. They're very different boys. And yet, there's something that is basically kind about both of them. They're quite different from each other and different from me.
Well, it's interesting. I just really, this is a hard question and you don't have to answer. When I see Mr. Rogers on television, we know what an even-handed person he is and never loses patience. But when you're dealing with your own children, hasn't there been any tendency where you might have done that?
To be angry?
I didn't phrase it. Has there ever been a time when you have done that, to be angry with your children and treated them harshly? A different image than we would expect from Mr. Rogers on television.
I haven't treated them harshly. I've never abused them in either physically or emotionally, I hope. But I have been angry with them. And I think that it would have been too bad if I hadn't. Because if I hadn't ever been angry with them, or if Joanne had never been angry with them, they would have never known that was an acceptable emotion. And everybody needs to know that it's all right to be angry. It's what we do with it that matters. And we don't have to do something that's going to hurt us or anybody else when we're angry.
Well, I have this feeling that Mr. Rogers is off camera much the same as he is on camera.
Well, you would know. We've had some time together.
Well, we don't have a camera, but we have a microphone. So. Well, it's really a pleasure that I've had the chance to meet you and admiring your work for all of these years. And I think these are beautiful books and a great benefit to parents and to children. It's a wonderful thing that you've done. You are really an institution in this country. In the most positive way. Thank you very much for spending this half hour with me.
Thank you, Don. I wish you well in all that you do.
Thank you.